Sound. Let there be sound. And there was. Good morning. Thanks for reading that, Susan. So you might have noticed on your way in this morning that there is a table full of coffee and snacks. And I figured that would be a better way for us to engage the topic of hospitality this morning. So before I say anything, I'm going to invite you to grab a mug, grab some coffee. There's also some tea. There are two types of cookies and some cheese crackers that Kim has made. And I will not say another word until your hands are full. So, go for it. So if at any point this morning your coffee runs out or you're more hungry, you can get right back up and grab some more. I'm not going to be offended. This morning I'm really happy to pick up where Ron left off last week as he kind of introduced our little mini-series on hospitality. And as Ron and I were discussing how to approach these sermons, we agreed that it would be really important to begin our time focusing on how we can first receive divine hospitality. And the great dinner parable that Ron spoke from last week, it's one of my favorite parables. I just love that one. However, often in my context, I'm prone to interpret that story solely through the lens of the servant who's sent out to invite people into God's kingdom. That's often the tack that I have taken with it. I look at all the different excuses that people will give for not saying yes to God's kingdom. But I'm always compelled by the beauty of this party that's never full. There's always room for another person, especially people who aren't used to getting invitations. I think it's a really beautiful picture of the ethic of the kingdom of God. However, when I focus solely on the servant and his story, it can make me forget that I am actually the one that I'm invited to the feast. I'm not just the person who goes out into the roads and the ways to invite people, but I myself am invited. I, a sinful, broken, anxious, tired, self-doubting person with a very, very long list of offenses, am invited to feast with God. So Ron, thanks for setting that up last week and reminding us of that hospitality that God offers us. So this week, I actually get to jump into the fray and talk about the outer workings of divine hospitality, or specifically, how to extend God's hospitality to the world. And as I reflect on being a part of this church for the past 10 years, I think often to the role that hospitality plays in our story. So it was actually many years ago now that I showed up here as Kim's boyfriend from Ontario. And I think I picked up the nickname Sandals Man because I was wearing sandals in a rainy March. So having grown up in a predominantly white church my entire life, it was an interesting experience for me to show up here and to be a minority. Except for, I wasn't alone. There was a guy named Fred who was there, and we kind of gave the knowing nod to one another, the two white guys in the church. But that's not actually my main memory of that week. No, what I actually remember most is the warm welcome that I received from everyone. People came up to talk to me, to ask me about my story, to ask me about my experience in Vancouver, if I was going to move to Vancouver. And I can remember leaving that week thinking that I could see myself returning here. I could see myself calling this place home. So when I talk about hospitality this week, it's actually with a personal investment in how hospitality is a core element of this church's life. It is what opened the door for me to root myself here. But, as I hope we will learn this week, hospitality is about a whole lot more than just making someone feel welcome on a Sunday. It's about attending to the needs of the stranger and the friend who's among us. So So this morning we're going to look at a few stories that I hope will help show us the way of God's hospitality. And to begin, we're actually going to start with the story that Ron alluded to last week, which is Abraham and the three men. Okay, I jump right into it. So we might know this story a little bit from the icon that's often up on the screen when we do communion. We're going to talk a little bit more about the specifics of that story this morning. So it's after the Tower of Babel story, when the world is divided into different nations and languages, that the earth begins to be filled. And at this point, Abram and God begin their friendship. And it's through a covenant that God promises to create a nation, this alternative people that will be blessed so that they can be a blessing to all of the nations of the world. So God is choosing Abraham, one person, to create a nation to effect change in the rest of the world. They will be God's people, he will be their God, and so begins the narrative of Abram, who then becomes Abraham. And when our story begins this morning, Abraham has begun differentiating himself from the other kings and the other nations of the world, living an alternative lifestyle. So let's look at this encounter with the Lord. So the Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. This is not the first time that Abraham has met up with God, but I don't think he actually knows it's God at first. For he looked up and saw three men standing near him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent entrance to meet them and bowed down to the ground. He said, "My Lord, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant." So three strangers suddenly appear at the entrance of Abraham's tent. And his first response is very telling. So at this time, when strangers come into your camp, they're not so much people you would trust immediately. They might be bandits, they might be thieves, they're untrustworthy. You don't know them, you don't have a relationship with them. And yet, Abraham's initial response is to bow down, ask for their favor, and welcome them in. "Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring a little bread, that you may refresh yourselves. And after that, you may pass on, since you have come to your servant." So he continues to honor these strangers as valued guests by offering water to clean themselves and relief from the midday sun. Then he offers them food for refreshment and makes a stunning declaration. He is their servant. He is their servant. So they said, "Do as you have said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of choice flour, knead it, and make cakes." Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the servant, who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. So what Abraham goes on to offer these three men is not a few rations for their journey ahead. Rather, he actually attends to their needs by offering the best that his family has. He chooses the choice flour, a tender and good calf, milk, curds, and he prepares all of them for these guests, these uninvited guests. This is not an immediate task that can be easily prepared from ingredients that are in the cupboard or in the fridge. No, these men would be invited to stay in and stay for a long while the feast is prepared. And a feast that it is. So let's think about this. Imagine, when was the last time a door-to-door salesman came to your door, or even a devoted Jehovah's Witness missionary? When was the last time they came to your door? You brought them in, you got the prime ribs cooking, you pulled out the fine wine and the 25-year-old scotch, and you wined and dined them. Okay, the Jehovah's Witnesses might not say yes to that, but So this is not an obvious response that we would have now. And at that time, I'm not sure it's an obvious response for Abraham to have. It's not how the rest of the nations of the world would respond. So while Abraham is far from the perfect person, he is the one that God chooses to work through for the sake of the world. And so it's important to pay attention to the nature of their relationship, how it functions in both ways. See, in this encounter, Abraham hosts the strangers really well. They are welcomed in, given a marvelous feast, and immediately and generously attended to. Now, if this kind of meal sounds familiar, it might be because you're thinking of another story that comes later that we're a bit more familiar with. A story of a lavish feast of great generosity that was given to an undeserving person. When we look forward into the New Testament, the parable of the two sons shows us a father who is excited to welcome an undeserving son back home. And when he calls to his slaves, "Quickly, bring a robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He is lost and is found." This travels all throughout Scripture. This initial model we see in Genesis is of extending hospitality is established. Welcome the other, attend to their needs, spare no expense. And I want us to keep this picture of abundant giving in mind as we move forward, especially in the Genesis narrative, because immediately it plunges us into a contrasting story of inhospitality. Genesis 19. Word of warning, when looking for pictures, never Google image 2 men at Sodom. Thankfully, Google Safe Search was on, but the Brick Testament comes through for all of our awkward biblical needs. So in Genesis 19, two of the men now, who were first with Abraham and the other man, they're now identified as angels, and they leave Abraham and visit Sodom and Gomorrah. So in a similar fashion, they're actually welcomed by Lot, but there's already this climate of anxiety that's surrounding their encounter. While the angels want to spend time in the city square, Lot persuades them that this will not be good. He knows the character of the city and its inhabitants. It is important to get these guests back to Lot's home, a place of safety. But still, the story descends quickly into chaos. Now, earlier in Genesis, the king of Sodom's character is established as an objectifier of humans. When it comes to the spoils of an earlier conflict, this king is not interested in wealth and riches. He's just interested in taking people. He offers Abraham riches. Abraham says no. But he just wants people. And we can begin to see his intentions for them reflected in the people of Sodom. The people of that city want the angels to come out of Lot's house, so that they may force themselves upon them. Sodom is not a town of hospitality. It's a city of objectification and of self-interest. People are objects to be used, abused, and discarded. We even see this influence in Lot. He's been there so long that he actually starts to reflect a bit of that himself as he thinks to offer his daughters instead of the men. The whole scene stirs the anger of God, and soon his judgment comes down through sulfur and fire, and Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed. And so out of these two chapters, we have two images. A tent of generosity, where the stranger is welcomed, served, and attended to. And a city of inhospitality, where the stranger is desired for personal consumption, and people are just objects to be used. I think it is significant that this interaction takes place so early in the Bible, as it really sets the tone for God's heart for hospitality played out in and through humans. In reality, Abraham is not the world's first host. In truth, that's actually God. So God sets the table in creation for all of his creation. The Garden of Eden, where the fruit of the trees are good to eat, and where humans can be at home. But at some point we became bad guests. And our heritage is that we reject his hospitality. But again, as Ron shared with us last week, out of God's abundance, he continues to be a generous host who invites us to feast and live with him. And through Abraham, we see this first example of a human reflection of the hospitable heart of God. And it serves as the model for us going forward. And if we pay close attention, we can see this heart for hospitality woven through, well, throughout all of the scriptures. Even Leviticus, the one book that, I say it's the one book that's the hardest to read. But I think I said that about Jude. And then I think I said that about Revelation. There's so many hard books to read in the Bible. But Leviticus has this part where it's talking about how we should be, how the people, the Hebrew people should be relating to those outsiders in their land. So the alien who resides with you shall be to you as a citizen among you. You shall love the alien as yourself. For you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So they don't have to be outsiders. You can actually attend to their needs and welcome them in among you. Then we have Psalm 23, that lovely little nugget in the middle. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. So in times of despair, the psalmist can trust in the hospitality of God. Or an oracle in Isaiah to the Dedanites. Bring water to the thirsty. Meet the fugitive with bread. O inhabitants of the land of Tamar, for they have fled from the swords, from the drawn sword, from the bent bow, and the stress of battle. As I was looking at this passage, I paused and I realized, well, we actually have had an opportunity to live this out. As we've been celebrating our church's 10th anniversary and the one-year anniversary of the Frungians, well, this is it. They have fled. But we have brought water to them. We've given them bread. We've given them home. And then this. Jesus at a dinner party, not being hosted very well. A sinful woman starts attending to his needs. Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has bathed my feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which were many, have been forgiven. Hence, she has shown great love. But the one to whom little is forgiven, loves little." So, I think to be hospitable is to attend with great love, care, and generosity to the needs of another person. So I'll just say that again. To be hospitable is to attend with great love, care, and generosity to the needs of another person. And as we see this thread of hospitality spun throughout all of Scripture, we get the opportunity to find ourselves in the same story in the lives that we live here in Vancouver. Just as Abraham is called to live this alternative lifestyle from the kingdoms and nations around him, so too are we called to live a different lifestyle of opening ourselves to others. But it's not simple or easy. And as I look at our current context, I think there are three challenges to offering hospitality in Vancouver that we as a church can actually see as a part of our mission or our mandate to address. So I want to invite us to look at some of these challenges with the same eyes that Abraham looked at the three visitors in his tent with. It's loneliness. As Ron noted last week, this is a real challenge in Vancouver, this issue of loneliness. It's difficult in this city for people to develop friendships with neighbors, colleagues, and even church community. Our society, as it becomes increasingly individualized, it creates pockets of isolation. And we ourselves feel this effect. So, how many people here are not originally from Vancouver? Put your hand in the air. Okay. Keep your hands up if you're not originally from Vancouver. So, you can lower your hand if when you moved to Vancouver, you immediately had close friends in the first month. Okay, the first 2 months. The first 3 months. The first 4 months. The first 6 months. The first 9 months. The first year. The second year. The third year. Okay. So most of us have gone through an experience of not having close friends or community on our entry into Vancouver. For some, that was remedied quicker. I suspect for those whose hands went down first, you were in university or studying. And so you're in a place where you're in a kind of bubble where there are people you're automatically rubbing shoulders with. But for others, it might have taken longer because this isn't a place where colleagues naturally get to know each other or neighbors. Even for Kim and I, we live on a street where there are two families, the houses right next door to us, with young children the same age as our kids. We never really see them. But the woman next door gave birth, 2 months after John was born? I think this was the first time this week that our kids went over to their house. Inside. Second time. Thank you. It's a challenge. Now, it's not just a Vancouver thing. I will talk a little bit about my experiences in Toronto, but it is true of our experience here. Loneliness is an issue. The housing crisis. So, I just hear me out. So with the real estate boom of the last few years, now we're seeing a city that is increasingly unaffordable for both owners and tenants. Housing has become an investment commodity rather than a shelter, and people are being pushed and priced out. But even our solutions, they actually create challenges. Challenges that are very problematic. So, the foreign buyer tax. Well, that can easily become a tool for xenophobia in our city, where we actually are making the outsider an economic enemy who we do not want living here. And densification. I mean, I think densification can be really good. It's a good stewardship of land and space. But it creates physically inhospitable spaces. we're now seeing one and two bedroom units become the norm for new developments in our city. And I was speaking with a former student of Kim's who's in furniture design. And the types of... He makes these really beautiful tables. He's from the prairies, so I think he just has this bigger mindset of people who can fit at a table. But that's not marketable in Vancouver. You need to be creating tables that fit two people in a 6 by 6 foot breakfast nook. Because that's the predominant design of condos in the city. And with that being the case, like, how can you invite your neighbors to come over for a meal if you actually don't have room at your own table for anyone beyond yourself and your partner? And with there being two bedroom units, I think some of the families in the room might feel this pinch. That actually is a natural form of birth control in Vancouver. The size of apartments. Because if you have, if you have a boy and a girl, they can share a room for a while. That's fine. But you don't want them sharing a room for, like, once they're hitting puberty. That can get a little awkward. And then you don't even have space to have a guest room for someone who might be coming from out of town or someone who is in a rough living situation and needs a place to stay. Systemically, we are in a place where it's really hard to be hospitable in this way. And then there's busyness. It's not possible when you're on your phone in bed to take a selfie of both of you on your phones. Otherwise, this would be Kim and I at the end of the day. Now, I could just go to bed, but I need to know what happened in the hockey scores. I'm in, like, Keith's in last place in our pool. I'm in second last place. I don't want to stay that way. But I need to always remain connected and know, even though I only have three players playing, maybe I can increase. So we live in this really fast-paced world, and it's really almost impossible to unplug and walk away from work or other responsibilities. And instead of living within limitations of, like, good limitations of work and life, we become boundary pushers who fill our lives with work, 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 sports, work, Pinterest, Facebook, work. The world around us does not take a day off. And over time, neither has the church. I mean, I say that working in a ministry where the camping end of our ministry, it's actually impossible for them to Sabbath. The way that they have all camps run across Canada, it's impossible to do a Sabbath because the campers leave at, like, Saturday at lunch and then they arrive Sunday morning. So that's less than 24 hours. And if one of the worst places to go is a Christian summer camp on the last 2 weeks of camp. Because all of the staff are burnt out. They don't know how to love deeply anymore. They only see the end of the month on the calendar and they want to get out of there. So this is really pervasive even within Christian ministries. There's always work to do, and when we're constantly connected to work, we have less time for family, and when we have less time for family, we have less time for anyone else outside of that. I mean, in my own life, when someone asks me how I'm doing, I'm always tempted to say, I'm busy these days, or I'm definitely tired. I even said that to Celia, and on the way up this morning, I was like, oh, I even did it right now. Because we actually inherently think those are the only proper responses. Rarely, if ever, have I ever heard anyone say, after being asked, how are you doing? Well, I'm well rested and living within good limits. I have the perfect amount of hours in each day to do what I need to do. No. So this is where a story comes in. Because actually all of those things have affected my life before I ever showed up in Toronto. So I moved to Toronto in 2009 to work at the University of Toronto with campus ministry. And when I went there, I went through the same thing that we went through in our exercise this morning. How many close friends did I have that first year? Outside of work colleagues who I felt like were forced to be nice to me, zero. And even by the time I left Toronto, there weren't many new friendships I had made that outside of my work community that have lasted well into my time here. So I actually went to Toronto and I felt really, really lonely. Before, I'd lived in Hamilton, which was half an hour away from home, so I could get home rather quickly. For some reason, it was easier for my family to travel to Hamilton to visit me, but once I moved that extra hour to Toronto, I think I went over a year before I had... No, it was 2 years before my whole family came to Toronto for a meal. Because they just had their lives in Kitchener-Waterloo and Brantford. So I didn't have family, I didn't have close friends. I'm in this fast-paced city, and in my second year, I started living in a community house, which, that one was better than other community houses I'd been in. The other ones I'd been in had been more, well, nice roommates who choose to have cheaper rent by sharing a house together. This one was more people who wanted to live together and live hospitably for the sake of others, but I was with two other married couples. And one of them had a kid, and so each of them had their own lives that they'd crafted for themselves in Toronto, and I was still the bachelor Dave, who was kind of a little immature still, still figuring out how to be an adult, but I didn't really fit in. And then this family stepped into my life. Their names were Ian and Naomi Elliott. Ian is actually from Vancouver originally, and he's one of these Scottish upper-class Vancouverites who grew up with Butlers and West End and left it all behind to do campus ministry. So he was living in Toronto. His wife is Jewish, and she became a Jesus follower in university. And on Friday nights, they would have Shabbat dinner. They'd light the match, they'd say the prayers, they'd break the challah bread, they'd have wine, and they always invited people into their homes to share it with them, especially people who were not Christians. They loved it. They'd say, hey, this is just a part of who we are, so come join us in that. And they saw that I was someone who needed a home. So while everything's crazy busy in my house, and ministry, like we have students coming in and out of our house all the time, no boundaries, no limits, they say, come and stay at our house once a week. So I do. I start going over on Friday nights for Shabbat dinner. Two of their sons are away at university, so I get one of their rooms each night. And I sleep, and I don't set my alarm. I wake up in the morning and there's coffee ready to go. There's the most delicious granola I've ever had in my life and a bowl waiting for me. There's the newspaper on the table. And Ian and Naomi are there and they don't want to talk about work. That changed my life. If I had kept in the rhythms that I had for myself beforehand, I would have burnt out. I would not be here today. I used to be a really mean person to Kim. Before, when we first met, I was really mean to her. And I think I actually changed as a person. I had the capacity to be nice. Because it's shortly after I started spending time at their house that stuff happened. Kim. And there's other parts of the story. It's not just this magical house. But this is a part of the transformation that happened. When people, they saw that I had a need. I needed people who were for me. I needed people who would say, get out of the rut that you're in. Come and have a meal with us. You don't have to pay anything. Just come. Drink wine. Drink some more wine when the first bottle's gone. Go to bed feeling really good. And then rest. Now, Ian is this guy who has become a close friend of mine over the years. And he's often the one who says, have you used all your vacation time? Yes. Well, you should just take more vacation. Like, don't worry. Just go. Come up. They're on Denman Island now. They've moved back out here. So when you hear us say we're going to Denman Island, it's because our family is going to recharge. Because they invite us to their farm to sleep in, to pick eggs, to eat great meat, to sit on the deck and watch the ocean and rest. These people have been a part of my life and my story. And so when Kim and I got married, the gift that the Elliots gave us for our wedding was a guest book. And that meant a lot to me because when I was at their house, every time, even if I was, if I came in at like 9 o'clock at night, and for some reason I left at 9 o'clock in the morning, I got yelled at if I did not sign the guest book. If you sleep over at their house, you have to sign the guest book. And what they have now is they have this whole shelf in their house of guest books for all the guests they've had over the years. They have histories of families growing up, of kids signing when they're like 2 years old and like scribbles, to moments when two kids who are visiting the house actually like they fall in love as teenagers, and their story is actually captured in this guest book, and then they come back years later married. They have histories of families that have gone through their house through these guest books. And so the best gift they could have given Kim and I was our own guest book, so that we could actually start our own house of hospitality. And if people remember, if people who had been to our first apartment know that it wasn't anything super special. It was a 6.5-foot ceiling with a really dark den with no windows. We didn't have much, but we still offered what we had. And it shaped our lives. So now we always, even if it costs us more money rent-wise, we always have to have an extra room in our house. We need to. This changed my life. And that really is what hospitality does. It changes lives. Back to Abraham's story. His life is forever changed by his encounter. Because of the hospitality he offers, one of the men who then revealed to actually be the Lord promises that Sarah in her old age will give birth to Isaac. Now, if you remember, he actually had the promise before that a great nation would come out of him, but they didn't think that would come from Sarah. So Hagar enters the picture. You get Ishmael. It's actually Abraham taking control of the situation. But now the Lord says, no, actually, it's going to be through Sarah. You've been a good host. Now your lives are being changed. I think hospitality changes the lives of everyone involved because the host actually gets to reflect the generous image of God. They get to participate with God in His work in the world. And the guest, well, the guest receives care and attention. And ultimately, a bigger sense of home and belonging. Things that I think address all three of those issues I talked about in Vancouver. Now, I do want to share with closing something that has changed my life. in terms of thinking about hospitality. As hospitality, the idea of hospitality versus entertainment. So you should know, growing up in my family, one of the things I often heard my parents say is they believed they had the gift of hospitality. They loved hosting people in their home. And for a while, we actually had lots of people who would come and go and live with us for periods of time. And yet, I can remember years going by where nobody would come over to our house. Years. Like, probably from age 9 to 18. So almost a decade. We'd see the same people week in and week out at church. We'd be friendly with our neighbors. But we never hosted anyone. And as I reflected years later on why this was the case, I realized that we were influenced by something happening in our church community. So in that church community, the people who did most of the hosting were the people who had all the nicest things. The first people to have a DVD player. The first people to have a big screen TV. The family that got the internet for the first time. The family with the in-ground swimming pool. The family with the newest living room furniture and the newest, biggest house to fill with that furniture. I can remember subconsciously striving for gadgets and possessions, thinking that that might change the story for my family. What we had in our home was never enough compared to other people's homes. And I think my parents unconsciously just believed this. And so their heart's intent was to host, but they felt limited by, well, our meager household. As if they had nothing to offer. Because the thing they would offer would never line up with this family that could offer this, 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 and this. And look really good in the midst of offering all of that. So about 7 years ago, I sat in on a seminar on hospitality that was being given by the South Asian evangelist who lives in the prairies. He had a really simple teaching and a story that completely changed my paradigm and helped me make sense of what happened in my past. So he said, "We need to discern the difference between hospitality and entertainment. Entertainment, which is what a lot of white Canadian hosting looks like, says, come to my home and enjoy my pool table. Enjoy my big screen TV. Enjoy my finest possessions. Come and be entertained." But hospitality is something completely different. Hospitality, it attends to the needs of the person, regardless of circumstance or possession. It's about the other person. It's not about having someone come into your home and affirm you for the lifestyle that you live. And I've seen whole like youth ministries set up this way, where the youth pastor has to have a house with all of the new video games and the projector screen and the really cool couch and sound system so that the youth group will come over and hang out. It's the only way. Otherwise, they'll go to someone else's house who has better stuff. Now, to emphasize this teaching that this man was sharing with us, he told about his own story of being a newcomer to Canada and having little possessions. In his family's first apartment in the prairies, they could not afford dining room furniture. But they managed somehow to find a folding table. And then they went to Canadian Tire. And they bought folding lawn chairs. You know, the aluminum ones with the nylon straps. So they bought as many as they could afford. And then they kept adding more when they had money. Really simple folding chairs. And before they ever had a presentable dining room space to invite someone into, they were already inviting neighbors to share meals with them. And lo and behold, their neighbors just become a part of their lives, and they start opening up the scriptures with them because they feel safe and at home. In their home, their first priority, like Abraham, was to be generous with what they had. In contrast to this, there can often be a misperception that we believe. We can only host people if we have nice enough things to invite them to enjoy. We can actually fall prey to the ministry of entertainment. Come see how nice my things are. This can be really dangerous. This can be really dangerous, especially in Vancouver, where we feel like we have to keep up with everyone else. It can actually take us down the same path as Sodom, where we are only interested in others if they serve our desires, to feel good about ourselves, to affirm the lifestyles we live, to affirm our own success. And if we feel like we don't have any of those things, how sad to think that we don't have something to offer someone in need. Hospitality, much like mission, is always, always, always out-focused. It's always about the other person. Rarely, if ever, about ourselves. Because we are humans, with rich yet complicated cultures and histories, we do have the capacity to be great hosts like God. But sometimes our own cultural baggage can inhibit what is true generosity, true sacrifice, true love for the other over ourselves. I've spoken out of my own experience as a white, middle to lower class Canadian growing up. But I wonder actually what those pitfalls and obstacles are for many of us in this room. I don't think it necessarily is the exact same as my experience, but I'm curious. Now, so our mission, should we choose to live into it, is to extend hospitality, extend the hospitality of God to the world that we live in. And this often will mean inconveniencing ourselves for the sake of others, of being radically generous with our food, our money, our homes, our time. Essentially, being radically generous with our lives. And I think this can be, and it actually already is, a really compelling witness in the world we live in. That is what will help people come to know the God that loves them and is for them. It will bring transformation into our lives, our homes, and our communities, and beyond. We get to host because God first hosted us. And even when we were really bad guests, He just makes the feast more lavish and the invitation more compelling. So all of that being said, I actually, with our coffee in hand, would like to have some discussion. I'm going to break, you can get into groups of three or four. There's two questions I want us to get to if we have time. The first is, what parts of our cultures help or hinder us from being hospitable? And then, once we talk about that, the other question, which these are always the type of questions I love. What could it look like for radical hospitality and generosity to continue to shape our church? So it's a pillar. It's a part of this church's experience. On the website, officially as a tab at the top. So you can't remove it. It's there permanently. And we've had experiences with that, but how can we continue to live into that as a part of our identity? So, I get you to break into the groups. Chat for about 5 minutes with the first one. If you need to refill your cup, go for it. I'm actually going to drink mine now. And we'll see what people have to say.